From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. America is obsessed with the spiritual. Today, Christian fundamentalists dominate much of the cultural conversation. But right behind them, Americans in church and outside it are chasing yoga classes, Buddhist retreats, Quaker meetings, sweat lodges, prayer beads, Ayurvedic diets, chanting, cleansing, bell ringing, meditation, and a liberal Jesus in a kaleidoscopic parade of spiritual seeking. Pop culture traces the spiritualism explosion to the loosey-goosey 1960s, but the truth and roots of America's broad-minded spiritual search go much deeper, says Princeton University religious scholar Lee Eric Schmidt, to Ralph Waldo Emerson, Walt Whitman, and a rich legacy of seeking beyond boundaries. Now, in an era of evangelical and fundamentalist resurgence, Schmidt wants to put that seeking tradition back on the table and acknowledge the millions of Americans still on that spiritual quest. This hour on Point, American Spirituality Beyond Fundamentalism. You can join the conversation. Are you a spiritual seeker in the church, in Orthodox religion, or beyond it? And are the heirs of Emerson and Whitman sidelined these days, or just going their own way? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from Princeton, New Jersey, is Lee Eric Schmidt, professor of religion at Princeton University and author of the new book, Restless Souls, The Making of American Spirituality from Emerson to Oprah. Lee Eric Schmidt, thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Tom, for having me.
Wow, you have opened up a big can. I'm tempted to say can of worms, but it's more sublime than that here. It's an incredible story. You're really working and hard to reestablish the kind of legitimacy and depth of American spiritual seeking within, but especially beyond strict orthodoxy. Why? What made you step up to the plate and say, I've got to speak up and stand up for this tradition?
Right. Well, I certainly sometimes feel outnumbered on this one. There's so much criticism from the academic left of these seekers as shallow consumers or naive globalists, and even moderates often criticize them, and certainly conservative Christians and conservative commentators do. So maybe it was just the obstreperous side of me, the contrary side of me, that thought I could step up and put them center stage. But more than that, more than my hips being a historian who likes to be contrary, I really do think that there is this long tradition of religious progressivism in the culture that and we'd all be better off if that were stronger and that voice were heard more regularly. So as a citizen, as someone who cares about the American polity, I'd like to see those voices heard more consistently and have that tradition appreciated more.
There's a very, very rich history that you lay out here. It's really maybe started out marginal, but it became, I think, to say central to the American tradition is fair. And I want to dig into that, but it might be good to kind of begin with what looks in your description almost like the end, or when things really began to fall apart or be set back for that tradition. You go to 1985 and the publication of the big bestseller called Habits of the Heart, a book that jumped in and said American individualism, which was, of course, closely associated with personal spiritual seeking, had grown cancerous. It was laying waste to the country's civic institutions and religious traditions. This was sociologist Robert Bella and his co-authors saying that liberal versions of morality and spirituality were kind of leading us to ruin, overblown ideas of self-reliance, self-expression, undermining the welfare of community, family, and congregation. I mean, they just kicked it right in the head, and it fell down. What brought this great vein of American spiritual life and seeking to that ignominious, not end, but huge setback?
Right. Yeah, it's a good question. I think partly that those sociologists were deeply influenced by the 1960s themselves, and a streak in their work is trying to save themselves from the 1960s. There's a revealing autobiographical piece that Robert Bella wrote at one point that where he describes his own process of seeking over a long period of time and then finally getting settled in the Episcopal Church again and feeling much better about his place once he got settled. So there's a way in which it's a self-critique in that, that there's a feeling of having been lost for a while and finally getting settled again. So I see it related in part to their own stories there, that there's some alienation from what they all had gone through when they were trying to save themselves in the 1960s. But that, of course, that kind of critique then was picked up in much wider circles, and there really was this sense that, and specifically that there was this history behind it, that, that folks like Emerson and Whitman were deeply responsible for setting the culture on this course to a kind of radical, cancerous individualism. And, I mean, there's a lot to worry about individualism in American culture, but I do think it's important to make a kind of distinction between what Whitman and Emerson are saying, which is really in praise much of the time of a kind of democratic individuality, the importance of creative self-expression, importance of seeking in the religious life in these individual ways, which doesn't necessarily set itself against community. It does value individuality, but it doesn't necessarily push to kind of an individualism that's just going to shun aside all social institutions.
Maybe we should do some defining here of how you're looking at this. I mean, you're talking about spirituality in the sense of eclectic devotions, you say, creedal, crossing, sampling, individual expression. To give a flavor of it, you quote Carol Lee, is it Flinders?
Flinders, yeah.
Flinders, the feminist spiritual writer, saying, and this might kind of bring it to life in one woman's mouth anyway, "I meditate as best I can on Native American prayers and Taoist verses, on passages drawn from the Bible or the Upanishads, on passionate love songs composed for the only beloved by a Spanish monk or an Indian princess turned minstrel." You're talking about spirituality that goes well beyond the church or any church here. Does it exclude the church? And what are the origins of this understanding of spirituality?
Right. Well, it is true that that's a particularly eclectic expression of this, but I think that eclecticism is an important part of seeking. There's this kind of cosmopolitan desire that finds expression in Emerson and Whitman and keeps getting expressed, where there's a sense that one's search should not be confined to one tradition, not confined, say, to Orthodox Christianity, but move flexibly beyond that. And there's a real commitment to that. Now, critics would say it's a very simplistic universalism, that people just dabble and move about and don't really know very much about these kind of traditions. But I think it's more serious than that. It really is a studied openness to religious worlds other than the one grew up in, and I think that's an important posture in the kind of world we live in. So that's a big part of it. Now, it doesn't exclude the church. A lot of these people are grounded still in the church. I think there's a lot of seeking in liberal Catholic circles, mainline Protestant circles, for example. It isn't exclusive. I think part of the reason why the rhetoric has intensified in the last 15 or 20 years against this is precisely because these alternative spiritualities have gotten a foothold inside the churches, so that you have yoga classes in the churches or meditation classes and things like that. So I think it's quite compatible and complementary in all kinds of people's lives.
But far from, you talk about the world changing around people. It seems to me that you mentioned mainline churches. I can think of a lot of mainline Christians who find a changed world from their own youth when this more eclectic, ecumenical, embracing, accepting Christianity was in many areas the rule. Now it looks like the exception in the shadow of a much more fundamentalist church.
That's true. I think a lot of people who grew up in the 60s and 70s and when liberal Protestantism was still feeling fairly strong, they're already feeling some erosion in its membership, don't quite know what to make of the current religious scene, which is so dominated by conservative Christians or the religious right that it feels deeply alien. And one of the things you get from that, though, is this sense that the pendulum might swing a little bit back in the other direction. A movement like Michael Lerner, a rabbi in San Francisco, who started this network of spiritual progressives, mm-hmm. For example, that there's some impulse here to say, look, you know, what has happened? We've got to get some of these this older ecumenical spirit back. We need to revive it. We need to work on those networks again. So there's some hope for that, I think.
You define spirituality as something much more than just the opposition to materiality. So how do you define it? What is part of this great American heritage? Is it everything from from yoga to, you know, bell ringing?
It is everything from yoga to bell ringing. Certainly that's true. I guess one of the things that interests me is just how that idea took shape in American culture. It's not an important way of thinking about the religious life in the 17th and 18th century. It's not important for most British Protestants to think about spirituality per se. I mean, they might talk about practices of piety or habits of devotion or things like that, but they're not thinking about spirituality in any of the kind of way that, say, Whitman talks about it. So it is that process by which the term takes on a new resonance, a new importance, as this kind of aspiring side of religion, as this fanciful, imaginative side of the interior life. And that opening up in the 19th century then creates the space where anything and everything can kind of accrue to it. So while there's all kinds of manifestations of it, I do think there's some common denominators, one of which is this real emphasis on individual experiences being at the heart of spirituality. That's one thing. I think this kind of eclecticism, this kind of disposition to borrow and move and be open is an important part of it. I think there's a strong emphasis on meditative interiority, that the practice of meditation seems to cross all up in all these different movements and traditions. So there's some common denominators, but you're right, it's wildly diffuse.
And embracing those Americans who say, I'm not religious, but I'm spiritual, or maybe even those who say, I am religious, and look at it in a very open-minded, spiritual way. Lee Eric Schmidt is with us. His new book is Restless Souls, The Making of American Spirituality, from Emerson to Oprah. You can join us. Are you a spiritual seeker in the church or beyond? Are you a yoga seeker, a Kabbalah seeker, a Buddha chaser, a Christian seeker out of step with the fundamentalist crowd? Join us, 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about American spirituality beyond fundamentalism, its deep roots, and its status in the evangelical era. My guest is Lee Eric Schmidt, professor of religion at Princeton University and author of the terrific new book, Restless Souls, The Making of American Spirituality, from Emerson to Oprah. You can join our conversation. Are you a spiritual seeker? Do you feel sidelined these days by the mainstream culture and religion, pushed out of the pew or coming back? And why did the tradition of Emerson and Whitman and liberal mainline religion fall into second-class status in America? Did the spiritual seeker path just become too narcissistic, shallow, New Agey? What's going on here? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Lee Schmidt, you describe spirituality as an American invention. What do you mean by that?
Well, it's not uniquely American, but there is a way in which this term just doesn't matter in early modern European Christianity and the way it comes to matter in the United States, that it really does take on a romance of its own in American culture. The term, and then so I don't want to be an American exceptionalist about it, but there is something distinctly American about this and the way that term gets morphed into this individualistic, solitary form. And the many of the leading expressions of it are coming from American authors.
Maybe the history of that invention, at least on American soil, illustrates that best. Take us back through the lineage, kind of starting, I guess, in the early 19th century, how this got launched in opposition to or beyond the church, how this path of spiritual seeking was first understood. Who were the great players here, and how did they paint the picture?
I think you'd want to begin with Ralph Waldo Emerson in many ways. I mean, he has this notorious address at Harvard Divinity School in 1838 where he really pushes this audience of would-be ministers to think about the soul more than the church. He himself at that point had already left the ministry and had basically taken up this role of public intellectual on the lecture circuit. So he's a founding figure. Another critical figure in all of this would be Walt Whitman. And in many ways, he creates a following around him that is more intensely religious or spiritual than Emerson ever does. A whole fellowship grows up around him. Some of his followers really think of him as a Christ figure, a poet, prophet. And he expressly makes this kind of distinction between spirituality and religion. What he wants is the spirituality of religion, the fire of these kind of spiritual ideas, not the corpses of institutional religion. So he would be critical.
You quote Whitman saying, "The ripeness of religion is doubtless to be looked for in this field of individuality and is a result that no organization or church can ever achieve." And on he goes. He's just moving right out of the sanctuary.
That's right. I mean, he himself has a Quaker background, so there's a strong Quaker element in all of this, but he really moves well beyond the Quaker meeting, too. I mean, he kind of rewrites the Quakers as kind of members of this open road, wanderers on the open road with him. The fact that he can do that then makes later Quakers in the 20th century rewrite themselves that way. And liberal Quakers like Rufus Jones and Thomas Kelly, whom I also talk about in the book. So that's right. I mean, Whitman is a key figure in all of this. He attracts all kinds of bohemians around him, many of whom have deep spiritual interests. One of the places they congregate is at this little community in Elliott, Maine called Green Acre, where there sometimes it just seems to be the Whitman Fellowship on holiday there. I mean, there's so many different folks who have been inspired by Whitman and, reading his poetry, hearing lectures about him. And then they're meeting up there with Buddhist monks and Hindu teachers and all kinds of others. It's quite a happening.
Now, it's interesting. You quote Thomas Jefferson. And, of course, he was from a different strain entirely. The number of many of the founders had were God was the very distant architect, not much bound by Scripture, but Thomas Jefferson predicting that Unitarian Universalists would one day become the dominant church in the United States. You point out that ended up being laughable. 150,000 or so Unitarians, God bless them now, and 150 million in other pursuits or more. On the other hand, you point out how mainline Protestantism did become deeply infected and unabashedly so with this spiritual questing culture that Emerson and Whitman championed for a long time.
That's right. I mean, I've had people look at me like I must be crazy to put so much emphasis on this Unitarian tradition of the 19th century, given how relatively few Unitarians there are these days. But I do think they have a disproportionate influence. The same would be said of the Quakers. There are only about 150,000 Quakers in the United States, but there's just no doubt that that tradition has had a disproportionate influence on the way Americans think about spiritual seeking and the inner life. So, right, I mean, you can't always gauge this by the sheer weight of numbers. I mean, they're by definition movements that cross out of their own bounds and flow beyond them. I mean, Emerson is a towering figure who's just read very, very widely, as is Whitman. And they're not bound by, their influence is not bound by the scope of Unitarian membership.
And so I guess I was trying to push beyond the Unitarian realm there, and to tap into your point about how much this infected the broader mainline Protestant world, Methodist, Presbyterian, you name it, those that were dominant for many decades with a more liberal, progressive sort of view of what mainline Christianity meant.
That's right. I think that there are Emersonians all over the place in Methodist circles by the 1910s and 20s. I mean, Methodist bishops who are nature mystics, Methodist bishops who care deeply about these Emersonian themes, for example. So right in the heart of kind of mainstream Protestantism, you're picking up lots of Emersonian progressive currents. I think the whole way in which this transcendentalist movement is linked up with radical social reform is an important harbinger of the social gospel movement in mainline Protestantism. So right, it's far from peripheral. I mean, its long-term consequences, I think, are very great. It's like the seed that's planted, and then it grows into something much more than it's a little transcendentalist club or mystic club.
And yet, here we are. We find ourselves in the early 21st century, and fundamentalism is the way of the day, though millions of Americans are still on their own paths and with, as you point out, Lee Schmidt, a lot of history to back them up. We're at 1-800-423-8255. Elizabeth is calling from Providence, Rhode Island. Hi, Elizabeth. You're on the air.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I grabbed the phone as soon as I heard your topic, and actually before your guest really got speaking much. So
you're a seeker.
I'm hoping that I'm on track here, but I just wanted to say I've been studying Zen Buddhism since the late 1980s, and I first got interested in it when I was living in Cincinnati, Ohio, and I found a strong community there. Mm. And then when I finally ended up in Providence, I found a strong community here. And I know that you were talking about numbers and that, you know, fundamentalist Christians, you're saying statistically outnumber all the other groups. But I just think that at least when I teach meditation to people, the people who come to the Providence Zen Center, they're quite often Christians who are also just have questions that they think maybe a bit of meditation might help.
Elizabeth, let me ask you on that path, if I may, how do you feel the American culture today, as hospitable or otherwise, then, to the seeking that you're doing and those around you with Zen Buddhism? Does it matter that fundamentalist Christianity has become so culturally and politically dominant, or do you feel yourself in a kind of subculture or alternate culture that's thriving on its own terms?
Well, I don't think it's either one thing or the other, actually. I'd say that those people who feel drawn to fundamentalist Christianity are very welcome to do what they're doing. I rather hope they don't impose too much, our way or no way kind of thinking. But I think that I just don't see much of a contradiction between quite a lot of what Christianity has to offer and what Buddhists talk about. If you go back to the passages in the Bible and look at also what the Buddha said, Jesus and Buddha were often saying almost exactly the same thing, using just different terminology. Mm.
And there's the kind of ecumenical spirit that informed much of the tradition that Lee Eric Schmidt is writing about. Elizabeth, we wish you luck on your way. I want to turn now to Holland, Michigan. James Herrick joins us. He's an evangelical Christian, professor of communication at Hope College there in Holland. He's author of The Making of the New Spirituality. James Herrick, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me on the program.
So we would value your perspective on what's going on here, this old tradition, American tradition of spiritual seeking in a time when the evangelical Christian movement that you're part of is so dominant. How do you look on this new old spirituality? Do you see it as a spiritual asset to the United States, or as an evangelical? Do you see it as a threat, as a lost way? How do you look at it?
Well, I, as an evangelical writer, have tried to actually alert the church to some of the complexities and some of the history of the kind of spiritual seeking that Professor Schmidt has been describing, and actually I would say that the history goes even much further back than that, which I'm sure he's aware of. He's looking at a particular American tradition that reflects some spiritual tendencies that were there, I think, centuries earlier, and that Christianity has always kind of contended with and tried to respond to. One of my concerns is that today the conservative Christian movement, the evangelical and fundamentalist movement, are not attentive to this particular kind of spiritual seeking. We're not engaging it, we're not answering people's questions, and we're not trying to address this by making a better presentation of the Christian narrative in the public.
So you're concerned about that because you see it as a threat or because you see it as an opportunity?
I think I see it as something that Christians need to be aware of. As a threat, I think maybe too strong a term, but I think that what's best, I think, is a spirituality that's rooted in some kind of tradition and some kind of authoritative teaching, and that has some kind of bases for assessment. One of my concerns about the kind of individualistic spiritual seeking is that it opens the door to so many potential abuses and also so many potential abuses of leadership styles and that kind of thing. My concern has been that we should be aware and attentive of what's going on here, and also try to frame some kind of Christian response to it and make a better presentation of the Christian message in public settings. I think partly because the Christian message has been so politicized recently, it has been heard almost more as a political message than a spiritual message. Mm.
James Herrick, stick with us. Lee Schmidt, I wish you'd sort of paint the two sides, if it's fair to boil it down that far for a minute here. the sort of spiritual seeking tradition you're writing about and what it champions versus the evangelical side that James Herrick is representing here, and says, you know, he's worried about these individualistic quests that may lead in away from the kind of authority and yardsticks that his crew would represent. What are the cases made for each of these?
I'd want to acknowledge that there is something of an evangelical left out there. It's pretty small, but there's certainly people out there in the evangelical movement like Jim Wallis who care about many of the things that the people on the more spiritual left do. But let me just give you some idea of, I think, the issues that matter to most of these spiritual progressives. There's a strong connection, for example, to the environmental movement, the screening of American religious thought. There's a strong commitment generally among spiritual progressives to feminism and the rights of women. These are things that are all historically grounded in the 19th century. Racial amity, racial equality, kind of radical abolitionism forward. Internationalism and the peace movement, a cosmopolitan globalism. There has historically been an interest in Native American religious freedoms, commitment to restructuring economic inequities, injustices, regulation of laissez-faire capitalism.
So
and
a
also,
huge political agenda.
Yeah, I mean, I think all of these things line up. I mean, it's not just so much an agenda, but I mean, all these affinities out there. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think sex reform, the birth control movement, sex education, these kinds of things tend to end up being lined up with spiritual progressivism. I think that a lot of those things aren't front and center with most evangelicals. I mean, certainly some on the evangelical left would agree with a lot of that, but many of them wouldn't. I mean, they just would see that as just utterly misguided.
So there's the political gulf, if you will, or the affinity gulf. But go to the spiritual issue itself. What's the spiritualist critique of the kind of school that James Herrick represents here, and why it's not sufficient?
I think that one of the main issues here is this issue around authority. Professor Herrick was saying that, I mean, there is a preference here on among evangelicals for a tradition grounded in biblical authority or in Protestant ways of making concrete that authority, Protestant catechisms from the 17th century or Protestant creeds from the 17th century. So there's that. I think that this liberal spiritual tradition is almost always pushing hard against that. They're saying they're putting an emphasis on the primacy of individual experience, the primacy of a kind of self-determination in the religious realm. And so there's always going to be a tension on that kind of point, a basic tension between a kind of spiritual individuality and religion of authority. So you're going to see lots of debates that flow from that that underlying tension.
And James Herrick, Lee Schmidt describes you as seeing that the spiritual questing path as freakishly incoherent and without resources of self-critique. You say you want to raise awareness or almost a kind of alarm to the fundamentalist Christian community. You know, people look out and see fundamentalism very prominent in American culture and life today. Does that look like a permanent thing to you, or do you always expect an ebb and flow in this culture between fundamentalists on top and this more spiritual legacy?
I think we're experiencing maybe something of an anomaly here with a kind of conservative religious right political influence in the United States. And I think that because this particular brand of Christian orthodoxy is not attentive to broader cultural trends of the type Professor Schmidt's been outlining in his book, it may lose a generation. I mean, when I go on to college campuses and talk to students, by and large, their feeling is that they're not being listened to by the people on the religious right. Now, I don't describe myself as a fundamentalist nor as a member of the religious right, but I certainly am an Orthodox Christian. And I think that across the whole sweep of evangelicalism through fundamentalism, we have been very inward-looking as a church, and we haven't been listening to the culture and haven't been paying attention. I also think that the religious scene is quite a bit broader than we've even been indicating here. I think that a lot of students that I run into borrow their religious ideas from movies that they've seen, from websites that they've visited, from television programs. And so the whole popular culture now has become a carrier of spiritual ideas. The spiritual ideas out of this more liberal progressive tradition, and a lot of other spiritual ideas that come from organizations that are in one way or another connected to that tradition. for example, earlier occult traditions, but also traditions that borrow from earlier, for example, neo-paganism is a rising movement. There are earlier Gnostic traditions that are reasserting themselves. There's a
lot on Americans' hearts and minds there. James Herrick, I know we have to let you go. We're very grateful to you for being with us today. Thank you for joining us.
Well, thank you.
James Herrick at Hope College in Holland, Michigan. Lee Schmidt, author of Restless Souls, please stand by. We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
Support for On Point comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston. Bicon Dental Implants, offering short implants that can eliminate the need for bone grafting. Information is available at bicon.com, BICON.com. And Private Wealth Management at Babson Capital. For more than 60 years, helping clients build and preserve wealth through financial planning, investment management, and trust services. In Cambridge and on the web at BabsonCapital.com.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about American spirituality beyond fundamentalism with Princeton University's Lee Eric Schmidt. He's author of the new book, Restless Souls, The Making of American Spirituality from Emerson to Oprah. And Lee, we've got to check on that Oprah point with you. We're at 1-800-423-8255. Tony's calling from Columbia, South Carolina. Hi, Tony. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Hi, Lee.
Hi. What are you thinking, Tony?
Shalom, namaste, blessed be, all that kind of good stuff.
Oh, we're feeling very ecumenical here. Thanks, Tony. Thanks for that.
Good.
I consider myself a universalist now after exploring many, many traditions through my life at the age of 47. Living in South Carolina is a very interesting thing. We have something going on now called Christian Exodus. I don't know if you've heard about this movement or
not.
What
is that, Tony?
Apparently, someone in California has organized a movement to encourage evangelical Christians to move to South Carolina, become more politically involved, and basically take over the state government here.
Sort of like Liberia, but different.
Something like that, yeah. It's kind of strange. This is one of the most conservative states in the Union. I don't know why we need any more evangelical Christians here than we already have.
And yet if people want that community and they find satisfaction in it, are you against it?
No, not necessarily. You know, the Mormons kind of did the same thing. You know, they were exiled first to Missouri and then to Utah, and now they basically control Utah. Maybe it's not a bad thing. Maybe it's a good thing.
But it sounds like it's when it comes close to political power that it's got you concerned, perhaps, Tony.
That is exactly the point. I unfortunately find an awful lot of intolerance within the evangelical Christian community or the fundamentalist Christian community. It's their way or the hellway, basically.
Well, we've got it, and it's got your attention, got you a little nervous there. Tony, we thank you for your call. You know, Lee Schmidt, I'm looking at this poll Newsweek did with BeliefNet recently. I was actually struck here by, they asked 1,000-plus Americans, can a good person who isn't of your religious faith go to heaven or attain salvation or not? And evangelical Protestants, 68% said yes. Don't have to be of my faith to go to heaven to attain salvation. Tony's worried about intolerance. The poll says even evangelicals, and of course 83% of non-evangelical percent said yes. Catholics, 91% said you don't have to be of my faith to go to heaven. So tolerance or intolerance, Lee?
I think those numbers suggest just how much effect American religious pluralism has had on the way American Christians think about the exclusiveness of their faith. I mean, the fact that you're getting 68% of American evangelicals saying that is a very significant number. Oftentimes, the sociologists pick up a gap between younger evangelicals and older evangelicals, with younger evangelicals coming in much higher in these polls in terms of that kind of tolerant spirit, a kind of more pluralistic sensibility. And again, in fairness, I mean, on the left, there is massive fear and intolerance of evangelicals and a lot of misunderstanding. I mean, probably many would be shocked that 68% of evangelicals said that. It's always a challenge to liberal institutions, liberal political groups, and liberal spiritual groups to figure out how they're going to deal with evangelicals or those that are making those kind of claims about salvation. So it's a long-standing challenge to liberalism itself to be tolerant of the illiberal.
And not necessarily easy because, of course, the hand has reached for the political power quite clearly in recent years. Julia is calling from Iowa City, Iowa. Julia, you're on the air.
Hi there. Good morning.
Hi.
Good morning.
Hi. I am calling because I'm a 24-year-old progressive Catholic who's currently in the process of applying to religious life. So,
what does that mean specifically, Julia? To become a nun?
Yeah, exactly.
Okay.
And probably in January, that's the hope, God willing, I'll be entering the Franciscan Sisters of Perpetual Adoration in La Crosse, Wisconsin. So,
do you see yourself as a spiritual seeker in the sense that Lee Schmidt's describing today, or something more orthodox?
I would say that I have a very ecumenical faith. I tend to read Buddhist and Hindi texts in order for an inspiration, in addition to the traditional Christian mystic writings and so on. I find a lot of inspiration in a lot of spiritual realms. And
you don't find that in conflict with your religion? You see the space for that within the Catholic vein you're mining?
Yeah, I find that what ends up happening is I keep on turning back and finding a way to implement the things I learn into my Catholic faith and, maybe practice some meditative breathing while I pray in my Hail Marys or something like that, integrate the two things together.
So there's the view. Julia headed off to be a nun. And Julia, thank you for your call. Lee Eric Schmidt. And she's taking the kind of legacy that you describe in American history here right along with her.
I think it's great to hear that kind of mixing of things. I mean, one of the issues that comes up is, well, how do Roman Catholics fit into this story? I mean, this seems so hyper-Protestant, this Emersonian tradition. So where are the Catholics connecting to this? And one of the things that a story like Julia's suggests is that there are these deep veins of progressive Catholicism in American culture as well, this whole Thomas Merton tradition of dialogue across Catholic spiritual traditions and Buddhist spiritual traditions, for example. So it's good to hear those kind of voices out there and to remember that vitality of the Catholic ecumenical left, and that's an important part of this. Initially, there aren't that many Catholic voices in the mix in the 19th century, but more and more by the early decades of the 20th century, you start hearing them.
So you're standing up here, Lee Eric Schmidt, with history, but you're also, you seem to have an oar in here for the liberal spiritual tradition. What's your sense of where that stands now? After the buffeting that it's taken, and we've seen a lot of mainline churches with almost something like a civil war between their more and less orthodox wings over who will dominate. What's the future that you see?
This is a delicate question for me. I do think I speak as a historian, but I do have an oar in the water, as you say. I mean, I don't think historians are just dispassionate reporters or just the facts ma'am detectives. There's a stake in all of this. I mean, and my stake is definitely among the progressives. The future here, liberals are always accused, have long been accused of just being hopeless idealists and overly optimistic. So I would hesitate let's discount too much optimism. But there's some reason for hope. I just think that the pendulum may well swing. I mean, it's the alarm that the Christian movement causes someone like Tony there in South Carolina that begins to mobilize people to counteract the dangers the Christian right poses to a more open society, and so you see it, and then that's there. And also then the statistics just seem to be in place for this. I mean, on that Newsweek BeliefNet poll you cited,
yes,
about 24% of the people seem to fall into the seeker category. That's a significant pool of people that's, not so far down the pole from the 30 or 40% counting themselves born-again Christians. So I think that it's a thriving tradition, has been for a long time, and I'm cautious in predicting that it will continue to grow.
Lee Eric Schmidt saying to all those folks, you are not alone, and describing the history of American spiritual seeking that comes before them. It's a deep one and a rich one. You put Oprah at the end of it. We just got a couple seconds, but why? Do you see her as a representative of all that, Lee?
I put Oprah at the end of it because she seems to be a condensing point for all this criticism of it. Oprah's taken as a sign of what's wrong with American spirituality, so she galvanizes all kinds of critics about how the whole culture has been Oprah-fied. So I consider her less as a spiritual writer and more as a lightning rod for controversy.
Well, there's a face on an old tradition. Lee Eric Schmidt, the book is Restless Souls, The Making of American Spirituality from Emerson to Oprah. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thanks, Tom.
In a moment, some illumination from writer Jonathan Safran Foer. This is On Point. Everything is Illuminated, the movie based on the critically acclaimed and best-selling novel of the same name by American wunderkind Jonathan Safran Foer, hit theaters last weekend. Starring Elijah Wood and directed by Liev Schreiber, it's the story of a young Jewish-American seeker named Jonathan Safran Foer, who journeys to find his grandfather's hometown in the Ukraine and to find the mysterious woman who saved that grandfather's life during the Holocaust. Here's a bit of the trailer.
Jonathan is traveling halfway around the world.
You my translator?
Forgive my speaking of English, Jonathan, as I'm not so premium with him.
To search for the woman who saved his grandfather in World War II.
It's my grandfather, Safran.
And this is Augustina?
This is our driver.
Please, do not be distressed. This is only driver seeing eye, bitch.
Wait, he's blind?
Only he thinks this.
One man's quest for the truth.
Why do you do this?
Sometimes I'm afraid I'll forget.
Is about to unlock a secret.
It is not so unusual.
What?
Not knowing.
That will change all of their lives.
Jonathan Safran Foer has since gone on to write Extremely Loud and Incredibly Close. But he first joined us at On Point when his book, Everything is Illuminated, swept the nation in 2002. To close this hour, we thought we'd bring you a piece of that interview in the voice of a remarkable young writer. I began by asking Jonathan Safran Foer to tell us a little more about the plot of his unique and moving story.
There's actually two stories in the book that are woven together, the first of which is about this contemporary search. A young American named Jonathan Safran Foer goes to the Ukraine to find the woman who he has been told saved his grandfather. And he's led on this journey by Alex, this completely inept and completely wonderful translator. The other half of the book is an imagined history of the town that they go looking for that Jonathan's writing. It begins at the end of the 18th century and moves up to the war, just as the search, the contemporary search, is moving back toward the war as history is uncovered. Mm-hmm. And these two versions or these two stories collide in a moment at which it seems like we have to choose between the imagination and reality.
And paint for us a quick picture of the talking broad that's described in the story that commences in the 18th century and goes forward, of the culture there.
It's very whimsical. This definitely is aspiring to a certain tradition, or I think it's coming out of a certain tradition.
Magical realism?
Yeah.
Folklore? Baroque?
Folklore, magical realism, a kind of Jewish realism, maybe mm-hmm. you might call it. Isaac Babel and Isaac Bashevis Singer. And mm-hmm. even to some extent, more contemporary writers like Philip Roth. There's a certain kind of energy behind it.
Mm-hmm.
An almost self-conscious energy.
And a cultural root that you can feel and that really makes things vivid.
Mm-hmm.
I want to ask you, Jonathan Safran Foer, about this, the meeting of your own Jewishness, I guess, that it seems that you to some degree found in writing the book. You said that you, as you set out on the journey to the Ukraine, really didn't identify yourself even so much as Jewish, yet the book is rich with a folklore and flavor of the shtetl in the Ukraine. Where did that come from?
This is a great question. I mean, there's lots of different kinds of Jewishness. The one that's easiest to talk about is observancy. Do I go to synagogue? Mm-hmm. The answer in this case is no. Do I keep kosher? The answer in this case is no. Do I believe in God? The answer in this case is, at the very least, I'm not sure. Probably no. But there's something else. You know, there's a division between, I think, religiosity and observance. One can feel like a religious person even in the complete absence of any sort of organized observance or subscription to any kind of organized religion. I think that I feel, in certain ways, Jewish as a religious person. Mm. I'm not even sure what that means. It might just mean that I feel that way, that to be Jewish is maybe to identify oneself as Jewish. To be Jewish is maybe to feel Jewish. That is certainly not a legalistically acceptable, mm-hmm. you know, understanding.
Right. But you brought to life this world that, you know, suggests someone who's been steeped in the kind of flavor and culture and atmosphere. Were you as a child, or was this sort of instantaneously absorbed from the ether of the Ukraine and Eastern Europe? How did you latch into that? Is it just come from seeing Fiddler on the Roof? It doesn't sound that simple.
You know, I spent one day a week for the first 15 years of my life either skipping Hebrew school or talking to my friends in the back of Hebrew school classes, drawing caricatures of my Hebrew school teachers, and obviously absorbing a lot of what was being taught there. Mm-hmm. I had no idea how influential this soil in which I was planted was, again, until I have this photograph, and I can say, God, however hard I tried to ignore it, not only was it, you know, taken into me, but it meant something to me. And when it came time to try to express myself in a form which had no constraints, nobody asked me to write the way that I wrote, mm-hmm. Nobody made any of the choices except for me, this is what came up. And it's really interesting.
Yes, it is. And it's a rich story. You famously use this wild, garbled lexicon for Alex, the Ukrainian guide that the young American Jew hires to take him on his journey, on his exploration. You have to have picked up the cadence of that from your travels.
I guess so. You know, like so many other things, who knows? Who knows where it comes from? Writing is a funny thing, and the more I do it, the funnier it becomes. It's not the case that the best work comes from the most work. It's not the case that you learn. You know, the way to know things is not necessarily to research them or be exposed to them. Mm-hmm. I think there's a kind of knowledge within us, and that is the knowledge of what would this sound like to me? How does this feel to me? What would be a believable Alex to me? And that's just completely distinct from the real world. And the funny thing about it is, people tend to share these very fundamental, deep things inside of them. They share what it is that they, how they might feel in a certain situation. They share different kinds of anxieties. I was on a radio show several months ago, and somebody called in and said, "Hey, I really want to thank you for telling this story that you told. It was really the story of my family." And I said, "That's great. That's wonderful. It's, you know, I'm very happy." And he said, "Being a black guy in the suburbs of Philadelphia, it's hard for me." And I thought, wow.
Not what you expected.
No. But you know what? I was wrong for not expecting it.
Jonathan Safran Foer, he spoke with us in 2002. Everything is Illuminated, the film based on his novel, is in theaters now. You can listen to my interview with him in full at onpointradio.org. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR, National Public Radio.